Sometimes certain characters in the Bible, the Torah describes them openly. You get to see the personality clearly, or some idea of the personality from the psukim themselves, from the text itself. I always think of the one that is presented most colorfully in the entire Bible, I feel, was King David. You see, you really get to feel that you have a knowledge of his personality. Whereas other individuals, their personality isn't that clear, it's more or less shaded. The most amazing one I always feel is Moses, because here's a man that is mentioned in most of the Torah, and you never really feel that you know his personality in any way. He's just, the only thing you know about him is he's giving the law, giving the Torah. And it could be for a good reason, because the Torah did not want us to really associate or to follow the law of Moses because of any of his personality traits, but rather because of the ideas themselves. So that his essence was to present the ideas. He spoke through the ideas himself. Our brother just mentioned to me an interpretation, and insofar as Moses' inability to speak, and he refused. The Torah tells us that Moses had an inability, or an insufficiency in terms of as a public orator. It was kavod peh. There was some deficiency in his ability to speak. And the question, of course, is why did God see fit that this should be so? That Moses, the one who gave us the Torah, the one who spoke so much throughout the Torah, should have some deficiency in his speech. And the answer, I believe, is that the purpose of Moses was not to impress us with oratory, but with the ideas themselves. So then, on the contrary, the fact that he wasn't a great orator was really more beneficial in this situation, so that people are impressed with the ideas rather than with his ability to win over an audience.
Isn't there an alternative interpretation of the same?
Yes.
And that is, Moses doesn't speak, not for a profound reason, but because that's the nature of the prophet. The prophet is not the sage. The prophet can feel and act in the world, but in a fundamental way, he's incapable of articulating. He's not an analyst, he's a creator. Very often we find, I think, when we look at a passage and we say, and Moses didn't really respond, and we ask ourselves, why didn't he respond? And we find excuses, well, it wasn't befitting, he didn't need to respond. Maybe the prophet ultimately can't respond. Maybe he's incapable, ultimately, of responding. It takes the sage later. Not as great as the prophet in some ways, but greater in other ways. Maybe it has nothing to do with the fact that he had cold and had his physical defect. The prophet cannot ultimately articulate. Moses is limited in his ability to do so intellectually. He just cannot function in that domain.
You feel that, in other words, Jeremiah was inarticulate? Isaiah was inarticulate?
Well, there's different kinds of ways in which, I suppose, one could be in a prophet.
But certainly, actually, the word Navi, you know what the root of the word Navi is? The word Navi. The word Navi really comes from Niv Sifasayim, which means enunciation, speech. So the word Navi, really, the essence of the Navi was to speak. That was the purpose of the Navi, was to speak to the people. And every Navi was an orator, a speaker. That was the essence of the Navi. The individual who is who is a thinker and who is not thinks he's a private individual is not a Navi. A Navi is only the prophet that goes out to the people. All the prophets went out to the people and spoke. So speaking is an essential quality in
the word sage, I think.
But there is a difference between the prophet and the sage, right?
Yeah, well,
some individuals are in a blurry space in between. There's a difference between the doer and the...
Yeah, but Moses, you said, was a prophet, right?
But
prophet or sage?
There are instances, which I couldn't go to, but there are instances where he doesn't respond as fully as we would have hoped.
Well,
the later commentators seem to have explained and spoken for him better than he did himself.
Yeah, but the question of what the Navi is, there's no question about that. The term Navi, the very term Navi, is a speaker. Nifsa Sion, the council of the term Nifsa Sion, which means to speak. So the Navi was certainly an orator. I mean, there's no question about it. Navi, and Moses was the greatest Navi. Is the Torah calls him the greatest Navi? Lakam b'Yisrael k'Moshe, Navi u'Mavit.
You're saying he's the greatest of all of these.
That's right.
Then what was your original point?
No, my original point was that since his business is to be an orator, to function as an orator, why was it that he had a deficiency in speech? That was the question. In other words, that person who is cut out to do a certain profession will be as if a man was cut out to be a mechanic and his hands were incapable of, he had some deficiency in his motion of his hands.
But he got the job done.
Yes, that's true. But I was saying that that it seems strange that God should preordain that a man whose very job demands, the essence of his nature is to speak, to have someone, to have the same individual be deficient in speech. This seems to be a contradiction. Because if God wants the man to be a speaker, so then it should be preordained that he should be a good speaker. He should have the tools with which to do his job. In this case, it's as if God...
I think it's a little confusion here when you talk about a good speaker.
No, that's what I want to get to. Yeah. The point is that what we were saying before was that Moses, it's true, he was a great speaker. But there are two different ways that people speak. Some people speak, they're able to influence other people through oratory. You see, the ideas that they say might be very simple, but they could rouse people. And Hitler Yimach Shemo is a great speaker. He's a great, he's a rabble rouser. But that is not the type of speaker that Moses was. Moses was exactly the opposite. His purpose was to influence people through ideas rather than through fancy oratory. So that's why, that's precisely why the deficiency was on the contrary, and in his case it was an advantage, because there was nothing else that could really influence the people other than the ideas themselves. But at any rate, I only mentioned Moses because I wanted to get an instance of where the Torah has a personality, and you don't really get to see or to know his personality. Noah is a case in which, if you look at the psukim and at the way the Talmud, the rabbis explain Noah, I think we can really get a glimpse of what type of an individual he was. Let's take a look at the first pasuk in Noah. That's Vav, Tereshis Vav, pasuk 9, Tess.
5, 9,
6,
9.
6, 9.
6, 9.
6, 9. Okay. Now the pasuk says, "Ela tolas Noach." These are the generations of Noah. Noach ish sadik tamim hoyev derosa. Noah was a completely righteous man in his generation. Eso elokim esalach Noach. Noah walked with God. Okay. I think we would be very proud to have such statements made about us, without any doubt. Nevertheless, the rabbis noticed in this praise some sort of perhaps a criticism. Let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi says like this. Rashi on the Derosa, that's the second one, says in his generations he was righteous. So Rashi says, Yesh me rabbasein adorshim asol ashvach. Some of the rabbis say that this was really an additional feature in his praise. Why? Kol shkem she'ilu hoyo b'dor tzadikim. Certainly, if he wasn't the generation of righteous men, he would even be a greater tzaddik. Because if in his generation of the flood, which was really a society that was corrupt, immoral, he was still righteous. If he was living in a better society, the fact is that environment affects all of us. If the environment was better, he would have reached better heights. So really, according to the first pshat, when they say he was righteous in his generation, it means even in his generation he was righteous. Certainly if he would have been in another generation, he would have reached higher levels, because the fact remains that an individual is always affected by his environment, and he would have even been a greater tzaddik. Yes?
The other problem is, when it's in the Torah,
yeah,
is the Russian has taken off on the plain meaning of the,
yeah,
Torah.
Of course.
So that, well, we get into this controversy of whether he's the best man in his generation, but not the Abraham generation, or he was very poor, we found that this gave us confusion. This gave us wars going on about locus.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Right. But it really didn't solve anything for us in learning. What we did come up with, just to throw this out, and I don't mean to cut you off, I'm sorry, okay, I know you want to get to the point. But what we did get so far is levels of comparison of tzaddikas. In other words, we had Enoch, who was described as not quite a tzaddik, who would fall back with him. And then we had Noah as a second level, then we have Abraham, and then we have Moshe. Right? And this has been a difficult business, is midrashim that come in constantly.
Right.
Sometimes they're useful and they help and enlighten it, otherwise they're very confusing.
I know they are.
Right. So we're not quite sure how to use them.
I understand. I'll tell you, you are absolutely correct. You see, the point is, that's really what I am going to try to do here. I would like to show you how we could utilize the midrashim and how one should go about in understanding and approaching the midrashim, because many of them are very confusing. And the truth of the matter is that when the proper method is that whenever you approach a midrash that you find seems to be out of the way, not really a part of the text, then you should know that there's something missing in understanding the text. Because actually a midrash should fit into the text like a glove. It should really be just a little more of an expansion on something in the text. If it isn't, then you'll find that it means that there's something missing in our understanding of the text itself. And usually, rather than working the midrash, you're better off going back to the text itself. And sometimes it opens up, sometimes it doesn't. The best thing to do when it doesn't is just to keep it in the back of your mind, and as we keep learning many times, different midrashim become clearer to us. That's what you have to. You can't, like, for instance, somebody asked me how he could study the Guide for the Perplexed from cover to cover. I told him, I said, there is no real way of studying the Guide for the Perplexed page by page. What you do is whatever you glean from it the first time you read it, be satisfied with that. And as you keep studying and growing your knowledge, perhaps other points will become clearer and clearer to you. And the same approach we have in Talmud. That's why when somebody asked me a question last night, I didn't have an answer for it. I told them, I said, sometimes we remain with a question. It's not the worst thing in the world. The school of thought that I was trained in, many times we left the Gemara, not understanding it. But that's the proper approach. Maybe there's another area which we need in order to understand that, and perhaps 5 years from now we'll see something which will completely open up the area. This time, rather than press it, you're better off leaving it. Because knowledge, you can't expect to go through something like the Chumash and understand every single point at one time. That's an impossibility for everyone. Let's take a look at this Medrash. I'd like to see if we can perhaps open up what this Medrash means. And then it says, V'yesh Darshim Asol Ignai. Some thought that this statement really was not in praise of Noah, but rather in deprecation of Noah. Lefi Doro Hoya Tzadik. It meant that comparatively speaking, he was a tzadik. V'ilu Hoya B'Doro Shel Avraham. However, if he was in the generation of Abraham, he wouldn't be considered anything. Which meant that he was, in his generation, comparatively speaking, he was righteous. But in absolute terms, he wasn't really righteous. Abraham was a righteous man in absolute terms, whereas Noah was, relatively speaking, a righteous man. That's the second interpretation. Okay. As was mentioned by Mr. Weiss, it throws me into a type of confusion. I'd like to see if we could remove some of the confusion. What would be the way to approach a medrash like this? Rashi really is nothing more than a drushim. Very seldom does Rashi say his own shot. The genius of Rashi was that he was in his selection. He went to the medrashim. If you take a look at the medrashim, there's so many that go so far off that he was able to take the medrashim which he felt were more or less in line. The first step in understanding the biblical text, the selection was his genius. But mostly, most of the things Rashi quotes are using the Russian. Once in a while, we'll do this again, but very seldom. Now, how will we approach a Mahalakos like this? What do we do in this case? What would be a proper approach? I know that this group works very very tediously on how to uncover the ideas of Torah, which is certainly the proper way to do it. But what would you say in this case? How should we approach it?
It seems they're implying levels of righteousness.
Yeah.
No, it's the phrase perfect from generation to generation.
Right.
Not the previous phrase. Noah was a righteous man. The question on the floor is, how do you deal with the phrase perfect from generation? Is it a compliment or is it a statement of derogation?
Yeah, but the rabbis are trying to tell us by using comparing to Rashi. Rashi is trying to tell us by using the variance between the rabbis that they're setting up conditions of levels in them. And they're using their comparison to say that what this Torah is trying to tell us is that there are levels of comparison of righteousness between Enoch and Noah and then further Abraham and so forth.
All right. Let me just try to shed a little light on this subject. You see, whenever you have an argument among the rabbis, what you have to look for is a common root. In other words, the arguments among the rabbis aren't that far apart as they usually appear. There is a common root. For instance, Maimonides, this is true in Halacha too. There is no argument in the Talmud as to whether tefillin are round or square. The basics were received by Moses from Sinai, and therefore everybody knew what the basics were. Once you get into the details, then each one comes in with his theory, you see. Now, what in this case would you say is common to both opinions? There's a common denominator here among both opinions. Let's see if we could find it. One says, even though it sounds like they're opposite, one says praise, the other one says it's a derogation.
They both said he's righteous.
They're both looking at the generation. Yes, but that would seem to lead us more into more afield because it's telling us that there are two opposite ways to look at the generation. I want to find out what's coming in there. So, of course, the word...
Definition of righteousness.
What?
The common definition of righteousness.
Where's the common definition?
Well, it's assumed that we know what a righteous person is.
Oh, well, there's two definitions of righteousness. Well, the first one would say that's absolute righteousness. The second one would say relative righteousness.
It's going to either the definition, God will know it.
Oh, with God, no, yeah, but that's the second half of the pasuk. That everybody agrees with.
He
still walks with God. Yes.
I think that it didn't have a level of comparison there. Where in the case of Abraham and Lot, I think that Lot was in a similar category to Noah. He too was saved from destruction. Also, Noah was being destroyed. He and his family were safe. Yeah. And it may be that if Lot had lived in the time of Noah, those two people would be comparable.
That could be. But the thing is, that would be more or less a conjecture on our part. What I'd like to know is, what do we definitely know from this pasuk? What do the rabbis definitely agree on?
That head and shoulders above anybody in this generation.
Yes, correct. But that's true. But that, as I said before, that's not a common denominator, because that leads us to opposites. One says he was ahead of his generation, which is praise, and the other one says derogation. There is a different common denominator, yes?
He's wholehearted from
this time. Right, let me tell you what I think. And then you tell me if you disagree, if you agree. Yes, go ahead.
Well, it says in the Rashi that had he been lived in a generation of righteous people, and presumably... in the generation of Abraham, at least not Abraham, there was righteous people.
Yes.
There, and that's a common denominator between the two.
That everybody agrees that there were righteous people in the generation of Abraham.
At least Abraham.
Yes, that's true. Let me tell you what I'm getting at, and then we'll see how you consider it. You see, I want you to understand one more basic thing. Whenever you have an argument among the scholars of the Talmud, it's not just a random argument, each one stating his opinion. If you understand the area properly, you'll find out that they bring out all the possibilities. So, now let's take a look. There's one common denominator between these two statements. The common denominator is this, that Noah did not reach total perfection. Either way, you see. According to the first interpretation, what does the first interpretation say? First interpretation says he would have been more righteous were he in another generation. Correct? What does the second interpretation say? Second interpretation says he was relatively righteous, but he wasn't absolutely righteous. So both agree that he definitely did not reach a point of perfect righteousness. Now, why is there an argument here? What are the two possibilities that a person has that would prevent them from reaching a certain peak? What are their only two possibilities? that prevent the person from reaching a certain goal. Two basic possibilities, I should say. A lot of side
things, One thing is regeneration. So they living in certain surroundings, which that is the great, it brings a person down, in a way.
Okay. All right. One thing is circumstance. That's what you're mentioning.
Yes.
Circumstance. A person is a victim of his environment. We're all victims of our environment. We're born in certain circumstances, we live in certain circumstances, and we can't do anything about it. The circumstances that we live in tend to affect us in limiting, and certainly they enhance us in certain ways, and in other ways they limit us, right? One can't deny it. There's another limiting factor of it, besides our inherent ability. Excuse me? A person himself. A person has the inherent ability that a person has, the innate ability that a person has. A person does not have abilities in math. He can't expect to be a great mathematician. Just doesn't have the ability. A person cannot deal with concepts in physics. Can't be a great physicist. It's an inherent factor. They're all limited inherently. Correct? Okay. Now, the scholars both agree that Noah had a limitation. The argument is as to what was the cause of his limitation. So, the first group say that they say l'shvach. They say if he was in the generation of Abraham, he would have been even greater. What does that mean, really?
Environment.
That's right. His deficiency was a result of his environment. Circumstance. The second say, no. They say that if he was in Abraham's generation, he would have been a very small individual. What does that mean? That means that actually his deficiency was a result of his innate abilities. See? That's the basic argument in the rabbis. They both start off with a common point. Common point is that he did not reach the mark. He didn't reach the mark of excellence. However, the question is why? And there's two possibilities. Either it's circumstance, or else it's innate ability. Okay?
What bothers me, that's very good. I mean, that's getting back to the basic argument about the inheritance or environment.
Right.
But as an overall picture of what the Torah is trying to tell us in relation to what we had before and what's going to come after,
yeah.
Why should this be relevant?
Okay.
Why can't the simple shot?
Right. Now, that's what I want to do. I want to spend a little more, okay? Let's see. If this is the case, that he had some deficiency, and the rabbis saw fit to tell us this, let's see, where else do we see? What else do we know about Noah that would seem to indicate that there was some deficiency? Does anyone know?
Yes, I think George told, or some commentator,
yes.
Other commentators, that he didn't take the trouble to teach.
Excellent.
Get the message across.
Okay.
For the rest.
That's right.
Isn't that the comparison that
Torah is made about? That's right. Precisely. That's right. One thing they say about him, that's correct. One thing they say about him is that he didn't take the trouble to go out and to see others, to try to influence others. But he more or less stayed by himself, built the ark, and did what he did his thing. Like I say today, he didn't bother anybody else. So this certainly is a deficiency. This certainly is something against the man, right?
Okay. You're saying that the more, is that a scale? Because you scale the righteousness there in a way that's really inappropriate. And that is, as you said, that to the degree, you could rank all righteous people on the degree to which they went out as prophets amongst the people and tried to change the ideas. For example, I think Abraham wouldn't stand very high in such a sense.
What, going out to the people? Abraham? Abraham went out to, that was his whole life? Going out to the people. Abraham's, the essence of Abraham was, his whole life was, Vayita Esho Gever Shova. Abraham's whole life was involved in going out to the people, teaching them about God. That's why he was thrown out from Ur Kasdan. He was thrown to Kitchen Age because he wouldn't keep quiet. You see? So that Abraham's whole life, he exemplifies.
No, it wasn't. He simplifies his hospitality.
No, but the hospitality and kindness was for one purpose. The hospitality and kindness was in order to bring people to the way of life of God. That was the purpose. It wasn't just trying to give a person a meal. It was trying to show a person more than that. It's trying to show a person the way of life of God. It was more than just an emotional hospitality, emotional kindness. It was, he wanted to bring the person to a deeper understanding. You know, Maimonides mentions that Abraham used to write argumentations against the idol worshippers. And there were, and these argumentations were passed around.
You know, if you did that would prove your point, except that they had to invent that midrash and show me some proof text for that. About Abraham's academy. I know all those things that appeared in our midrashic things.
Right.
And it's exactly to prove your point. If all those were true, then you're right. Your defense of Abraham would be right. But they're not in the text at all.
Well,
they're,
you know,
they're made to prove the point.
Well, the point is this, that I mean, if you want to discuss what the authenticity of the Talmud is, I think that we have to take
no,
up
I
another...
Wouldn't.
No, I'm just saying.
Oh.
In other words, if we're questioning the authenticity of the Medrash, that would definitely be a different topic. But I am
but
here assuming...
There's
only Medrash.
Whether there were academies...
Those are
Medrash.
Those are Medrash, yes.
Right.
Now, I assume that the class tonight is going to be an understanding of the Medrash, but... A class on what the authenticity of Medrash is would be a totally different class altogether. In other words, you're bringing a premise here which is not really a part of the subject matter at hand right now. That certainly is a worthwhile discussion, but I think
so
that if we go into that, I would have to give an entirely different class tonight than I'm here for. And not that I would say that's not valuable. I would certainly do that. But we'll have to set up another time and I'll come down and I'll give a class on
that. Abraham, in order to have been more righteous, had to have done these things implied by the Midrash that the Torah didn't choose to enumerate.
Well,
and that the Midrash, therefore, to the degree that we don't accept that Midrash, that degree we lower his righteousness.
If you want to know about Abraham in particular, the fact that Abraham had a following is openly in the Bible. First of all, God changed his name from Avram to Avraham. Because God said to him, Av Hamon Goyim Satifai, made you the father of Hamon Goyim, means multitudes of nations. Now, obviously, he had a following. The man is, if the man's title is changed by God to the father of multitudes of nations, obviously he had a following. Openly, you have in the Torah when he went to battle against the kings, Vayarek Eshanichov, several hundred people were with him. And also, when he did Milah, it says, Kol Yilide Beso, his entire household, he did the circumcision too. So obviously he wasn't a lone individual.
A very wealthy man, extremely successful, capable.
Yes, not only successful and capable, but he was an individual who had a following. Av Hamon Goyim means that he was the father. Now, God didn't call him that because he was wealthy. When God called him the father, he meant in terms of knowledge, in terms of understanding. So obviously from the Bible itself, you can see that Abraham was a leader of many, many people. And that's why the Medrash is certainly not far-fetched. Abraham was an individual who had a great following, both in the Bible, and Medrash merely explains, gives us additional features of his method of approach and what he did.
I'm not trying to thank Abraham so much to understand the point you're making about Noah. In that scale, then, you would say Noah is at some low level of righteousness,
yes,
because we have a scale of outward goingness, right?
Yes.
So Noah, Abraham, Moses, and we could put him on a scale if we could.
Well, I don't like the term scale. I mean, scale really is a... poor term for this type of description. I would let's merely say at this point, maybe later we'll be able to understand what exactly it is, and that's what I'd like to elaborate on. But I would merely say it's a deficiency in the individual. Yes?
What could you do, Rabbi, with the word coming?
Okay. Alright.
We know it means perfect?
Yes. Okay. We'll get back to that. That's a good question. Let's not forget that question, because when I get finished, I hope that these questions will be answered. Okay. Let me continue. So we find Noah, and that the rabbis say that Noah was imperfect. There was no perfection. What the cause was is a debate among the rabbis. Environment or his own inabilities. Okay. Let's take a look at another midrash that's brought in the Chumash. 7-7. Okay. Alright? It says, Vayovo Noach, Noah came, Uvonov Ishto, and his sons, and his wife, and his Shevonov, and the wives of his sons, Ito, 7-7. Have you got it? It says, Noah came and his sons and his wife and the wives of his sons with him to the table, to the ark. Mipnei me'amavol, because of the waters of the flood. All right? Now let's take a look at Rashi again. At Rashi on that text. What did Rashi say?
Does everybody have it?
Yeah. That's a hurt. It'd be easy to follow it. It's a hurt to
All right. Rashi says, "Af Noah miketane emunah." Noah was miketane emunah. What does that mean? Everybody know what it means? Miketane emunah means he didn't really have complete emunah. It means belief. He didn't have complete faith. Okay, he was very small on the scale of faith. He believed and he didn't believe. Okay, sheyavo hamavon, that the flood will come. Then it says, "Below nichnas l'teva ad shedachaku amayim," and he didn't enter the ark until the waters forced him in, because the pasuk, the rabbis are very cautious when they approach this pasuk, because they notice there's a redundancy here. It's an unnecessary statement. It says Noah and his wife and his children all went into the teva because of the waters of the flood. Well, obviously, we know the whole chapter is discussing the flood. Why does it have to be because of the waters of the flood? What is the extra word in here? So the rabbis say that this extra wording has significance in terms of Noah's personality. That Noah wasn't completely convinced yet. He was convinced, but he wasn't. He believed and he didn't believe. He had faith and he didn't have faith that the flood was going to come. But when was he convinced that it was going to come? When he saw the waters rising. And then he felt...
There's another interpretation.
Yes.
It was that it wasn't a lack of faith, but rather a hope and a faith in his fellow men.
Yeah.
That they would...
They would change.
They would change. Okay. They wouldn't right. change.
That bothers me.
It was actually told by God after 7 days,
and I have the flood. And after 7 days, he goes into the ark.
Right.
He follows all this strictly.
Right.
And it seems to me that
there's
this superimposed
tzaddikus
over his actions.
Yeah.
And that they're trying to read out something to make
homiletics
out of it.
No. Well, yeah. Okay. Let me just approach it this way. There might be other interpretations, but let's for a moment take this interpretation. Okay. All right. Now. I'd like to see. Let me just explain one thing to you. When you see an interpretation on a pasuk, again, it might sound strange to you. The best thing to do is one of two things: either look back at the pasuk, or else try to understand the interpretation itself, and then perhaps you'll see how it fits in. Now, what does this mean? Let's forget about how it fits into the pasuk. I don't care if it doesn't fit into the pasuk. Apparently, the Medrash thinks that this was true of Noah. Let's understand the idea per se. It's not in the pasuk. So what? Well, let's understand the idea about Noah. Let's say the rabbis told us an idea about Noah. Let's understand the idea. Okay. The concept is, it says that he believed and he didn't believe. Now, what is difficult in that concept? What is difficult in that concept? It says he believes and he doesn't believe. It's an inherent contradiction, basically. Right? It's two mutually exclusive terms. A man is a believer or is a non-believer. But to be a believer and non-believer simultaneously is very strange indeed. Correct? Okay. Now, this is really the most basic problem that we face when we see the Medrash. Forget about how it fits into the text. It doesn't bother much. But what is the Medrash saying? What's the essence of what the Medrash is telling us? How would you explain this? How would you possibly answer this?
He didn't have perfect faith.
He didn't have perfect faith. But it says he was in contradiction. He was in contradiction. Believed and didn't believe. It seems like, how could a person at the same time, believe and not believe?
Read exactly.
Af Noah also was of those who have little faith. Mamin the Eino Mamin. Mamin means believes. Ani Mamin. Eino Mamin? He doesn't believe. Yitzhak Tov and Yitzhak Hara. Okay, that's an approach and it's on the way. Why don't we make it a little more precise? Yes.
Perhaps he could believe if he had something concrete to show him of water rising.
Good.
But unless he saw something really definite, he wouldn't have what perhaps it won't happen.
Okay. All right, good. Yes, that's good.
And it's reminiscent of the light of the
way through the Midbar. Yes. Okay, we'll accept that too. Let me just try to find it. Yes.
There's fluctuating. Yes, between believing or not or doubting.
Fluctuating. You know, one time he believed, and another time he didn't. I don't think that's so, because if that was the case, he would have gone in and gone out.
Well, I could have interpreted it as a compliment also. You know, one could say that that's a compliment.
Saying, had a little faith?
No, that he was, sometimes he believed and sometimes he didn't. That's he stuck to the fact that he was a man of ambiguity, and that is, he was a man who understood a subtle belief in faith.
Yeah, but the rabbis say he was miktane emunah. Miktane emunah means that he was very low in terms of faith. The point too, he was great in faith. The rabbi said miktane emunah means that he was low in faith.
Well, I have to resolve the contradiction between the second part of the sentence
and the first. Well, you'd
have a big problem. I'd have to be a midrash.
That's right. You'd have a lot of problems that way. Yes.
Faith is belief without question.
Yes. Okay. Right, faith is not belief without question. So there's a problem even in the contradiction.
If you take Bob's type, then he believed, but he questioned his own belief.
He believed and questioned his own belief.
Yeah, which is not a terribly alien idea.
Okay. All right. Let me see if we could perhaps understand the personality of Noah a little better, just from this text. There's another question. Before we answer this, I just want to explain one more thing. We said before that Noah didn't go out to the people, right? Now, I want you to understand that this is no small criticism. As a matter of fact, what disturbs me about that is that if that is the case, as far as I would say such an individual doesn't deserve to be called righteous at all. What's really perplexing about that matter is that Noah did not go out to the people is, if that's the case, then what kind of an individual was he?
Yeah,
I mean, after all, let me ask you a question. What is more important in the eyes of the Torah, giving a person food or giving him knowledge? What would you say?
In terms of the Torah.
No, I don't mean to starve him. I mean to say, give him tzedakah to an Indian. He's not going to starve, but he needs a little more. He's uncomfortable. Knowledge certainly would be considered a greater thing than food in the event that a person is starving, right? Okay. Now, what would you consider an individual who would not help a poor person? Give him a little better supper, better lunch. Help him make his life a little more comfortable. Would you consider a person like that righteous? Certainly not. So, well, that person doesn't understand the very basic idea of humanitarianism. A man that has no idea of humanitarianism. Now, let me ask you this. If that is the case with food and with clothing and shelter, which are physical necessities, how much more so should it be with knowledge? After all, the entire Torah is based upon the concept that man rises to the highest level through knowledge of God. So therefore, knowledge, it would be worse for me to withhold knowledge from others than it would be to withhold food. And we know that even withholding food, the person does such a thing, he's not considered to be righteous. So how could we consider Noah righteous if he didn't go out to see other people? Now, this is a question that disturbs me more than how the Medrash fits into the pasuk. Yes?
That doesn't disturb me.
Why not?
I think that's taking it from the point of view of subjective humanity. How does people react? But I don't think that's what Torah is all about. Torah is what God's purpose is of having these people react or act in certain ways. And whether he goes out to other people or not is almost irrelevant to what the story is about.
Is it irrelevant? Well, you mean to say that a person that doesn't go out to help others would be considered righteous?
No. What I'm saying, and for God's purposes, he is righteous.
What I'm saying is this.
We've had a running debate going on here. As to the question...
Right in the middle of the debate.
it's a long time ago.
Several thousand years.
One of the latest ones we've had. Yes. Almost bothers us because it's almost a criticism of God. We seem to see almost a change in direction. Where God starts off with Adam and Eve, gives them one commandment, they completely fall apart. They can't have it.
Right.
We then have Noah, who God says, well, this is the one individual, I'll bank on him, and I'll give him certain commandments, maybe with those commandments he can live. Now, the question of how he relates to other people really hasn't concerned us too much. It's really a question of, can this one guy, Noah, carry these commandments and establish a world order? Eve then fails, and God ends up with Abraham, who apparently passes off tests, and can carry the world order, and God banks on the Jews as a people. The running debate we have then is, what is Abraham going to do? I mean, is the purpose of him to go out to the world, or does he stay as Jews?
Well, the contradiction that I have is very simple, right? I'm not sure if you... Kirby alleges the argument, right, that there's a quality of righteousness, and that is, it's outgoingness. And we argue about that for a while. And once he persuaded you that, he says, see, righteous but not righteous, you can go out.
I don't think anyone here doubts that helping others is righteousness.
Right.
Can you do that?
Right.
You
make
no. So I don't have to lead you to that argument. I mean, it's certainly a premise which we all assume that helping another person is righteousness. I mean, you don't deny that, do you?
I don't deny that that's a righteous act. Whether
you don't think that really partakes.
Whether a man could be, whether it could say that Noah was a righteous act, despite the fact that Noah did not go out. It's clearly shown by the Torah that it does say.
Yeah, I know, but that's the question. That's the difficulty. what we have to do is, what we're trying to do is to understand the Torah. If you're just going to tell me, well, the Torah says he's righteous, he's righteous, we can close the chumash and say we believe everything in the Torah. God is wonderful, and that's it. But apparently God wants us to understand what he means in the Torah, not merely to accept him and say, yes, he's wonderful, and then there's no reason to understand. That's what we're here for, yes.
On relative terms, you view from God's eyes, but we can't, I don't know how you can do it.
Well, anyways,
from the objective looking in, Noah's relation to other people is almost irrelevant for God's purpose. The question is, what is
it's irrelevant for his purpose? But I'm asking you a question. The Torah depicts Noah as a righteous man, true or false?
In his generation?
I'll say, just not his mother. But the term righteous, let's say, for instance, according to the ones that say, even the first shot. The first shot says that Noah was righteous, and if he was, had he been in the generation, he would have been even more righteous, right?
Is it because he follows orders? Is that from God's
you mean,
point of view?
That's what righteousness consists of, just following orders? That's a righteous, that's Sadiq Khan,
that's
righteous.
Right,
I have a different idea of righteousness than I do. I mean, I consider a righteous person a person that is good, a person that gives of himself, a person that has knowledge, a person that has understanding. There are many qualities that go into righteousness.
Rabbi,
but I can't visualize a righteous person being a selfish individual. I mean, to me...
That may be true, but I think the only problem that bothers me there is what you said, right, when we go back to the generation, because remember, now you also had the benefit of many centuries of addition to this knowledge about a basic definition of righteousness that maybe Noah didn't have. In other words, you go through Abraham, you go through Moses, you've got these various laws that perhaps Noah didn't have at that particular time, and therefore he had his basis for comparing what he did. And you know, somebody gave a command, build an ark. You know, Abraham really wasn't told to build an ark, so perhaps he could, you know...
I mean, this was before the discovery of kindness.
Well, as far as, no, I think as far as the definition of things, as far as kind and unkind, you know, I guess it was a moral law.
Are you hung up on the ambiguity of good deeds and righteousness?
I think this is what I'm questioning.
Well, how do you separate those two concepts? Because when you said, oh, I know what righteousness is, it's going out and being kind.
I didn't say
separate the idea of the man of good deeds and the man who is righteous.
Now, I
knew that the flood was
going to
come, and he knew that the flood was going to kill all of humanity that was left except for his family. Still didn't go out.
Let me ask you a question. We're sitting comfortably in this room, right? We're sitting comfortably in this room. If we took a look across the street and we knew that a man's house is going to explode in an hour and we sat here and we didn't do anything, would you say that God should call us righteous?
We know.
I think that settles it, basically. I don't see how you could possibly conceive
a righteous individual.
That's exactly the example we have. A man knows that people are going to be destroyed. This isn't a joke.
But yeah, he's still called righteous.
And so then he's still called righteous. That's my question.
That's exactly my point. We're not calling him righteous. The Torah is calling him righteous. I think this gets back to the next. Let me assume that. So then it doesn't make any sense of what the Torah is saying. It doesn't make any sense in offering a reference, right? That's where the question is. Well, it's possibly a criticism. I'm just throwing out this question. Is this a question of a whole concept of Torah? And I'm not trying to be a wise guy. But possibly one looking at this might say the Torah's concept of righteousness is that he simply follows orders within his parameters of what he's asked to do.
Right? We're the robots. That's
the robots. Exactly.
That's what God wants us to be.
Well, you know, possibly this is the biggest way to start.
That's what God wants us to do.
Oh, we didn't say
no,
that.
No,
us.
You see,
say that.
Well, the Torah
levels,
can maintain. If you're telling me, again, you're telling me an individual stands by while others are destroyed and does nothing, and this is considered righteous. Is that what you're saying?
I know, but I don't understand that.
I mean, then what we're trying to do is to understand. Okay, then rather than twist our minds into accepting something which doesn't make any sense, let's for a moment try to understand, maybe we can understand what the Torah means. But I'll tell you in general, that the approach is, one should not, you know, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, his grandfather was known for leaving many problems unresolved. He was in his day the greatest scholar in the world. Why? Because he used to say, it's better to have a difficult question than a difficult mind. So rather than twist your mind into accepting something which doesn't make any sense, I'd rather say, we don't understand it, let's leave it go. Let's take something else. But let's not twist our minds into saying something which is completely absurd, saying that a man who sits at home while others are dying is considered righteous. This doesn't make any sense. Okay. Now, let's take this. Let's go back to the other round.
No, you got to resolve that dilemma.
I will resolve that. Absolutely. I don't know to his satisfaction. Now,
then you want a sequel to the question? Is that the question?
This is a rough group. What are they doing here? Now, It says that Noah believed and he didn't believe. Let's get back to that point. What exactly, how could a person have this ambivalence? All right, psychologists say a person can have ambivalence. But I would like to understand it philosophically. What exactly it means. You see, a person has two parts to his nature. He has his intellect and he has his emotions. Correct? Okay. Now in life, however, we find that one doesn't always follow the other. Many times we know certain things, but we have certain feelings about those same things. Sometimes an individual will find that he has certain symptoms, which is knowledge that lead him to the conclusion that he should go see a physician immediately. But then he might have certain feelings about that, which sort of counter that. So just a minute, where are you running? There's nothing, forget it, there's nothing wrong with you, you're okay. See? There's a conflict. Oftentimes in human life we find that people have conflicts. And very often, a person decides he wants to do a good deed. And suddenly he finds that he wants to do it. The thought was very good. But his emotions don't seem to go along with what he planned. And not only insofar as mysticism is concerned, insofar as everyday life is concerned. People understand something one way, and they find that they have conflicting feelings about it. Now, what I want to say in regard to Noah is as follows. First of all, that the most perfect man, and I say this even though I realize that we aren't speaking in our own frame of reference, but nevertheless, we shouldn't be prevented from seeing greatness, true greatness, even though we, in our lives, might not be able to attain such a height. But I maintain as follows, that the true great man has no conflict. He's developed to the point where his whole being follows what he sees and what he understands. Now, when the Torah says that Noah believed and didn't believe, what it means is that he heard the word of God, and logically, he saw it was right. Logically, it made sense. But nevertheless, his feelings just somehow didn't go along with it. I'll give you a good example, just for radiation. Radiation, as we know today, is carcinogenous. It causes cancer. And it was known for many years. They knew this in the 20s and the 30s. Nevertheless, they never really heeded the warnings that were given to them. They saw people, the experiments were made a long time ago. And I read this in a textbook on physics many years ago. And they said, the text was strange, but that's the way it was. You know why it was that way? Very simple reason. Even today, they're first finding out certain things, which 20 years ago, they didn't think were dangerous. Now they're finding out things. The reason is very simple. Because we were always used to a type of result which you feel immediately. A person puts his hand in fire, it gets burnt. Oh, that's bad. But radiation, you don't feel it. A person can stay under radiation for a half hour, won't feel anything immediately. The effects will be postponed. And we tend to deny certain effects which are long-term, because we don't see them immediately. So logically, we might see it, but somehow or other, there's a conflict there. And until we see it repeatedly, then we can't absorb it. We can't really accept it fully. And I say Noah was caught in the same conflict. He heard the word of God. God told him that there was going to be a flood, but his feelings didn't go along with it. Here he saw a civilization that was so secure. Everybody was living the way they kept on going, everyday life. Nothing was interrupted. And it seemed like a secure society. You mean there's going to be a total upheaval of everything that we have here? A civilization that would be completely annihilated? It was something which went against his feelings, his emotions. Yes, God told me that, but rationally I see it, but emotionally it doesn't follow.
Yeah, wouldn't it also follow an understanding of God? A God of mercy and a God of justice.
Right.
How is it possible that such a...
Okay, well, that's a different question. What the mercy and justice is involved in.
I think I'm going to deal with that Sunday night.
That's a different aspect. But at any rate, the point is that an individual who is on a truly perfected level, his emotions will follow. Not only will he see it intellectually, but he will feel it too. And in life, that's the way it is too. People who are more successful in different areas, it's usually because they are able to, they're convinced about certain ideas, whereas most people will remain, I'm not so sure it's going to happen. Because they feel change will not occur. But then again, there's always those few people who see it and who are convinced just on the basis of the knowledge themselves. This is a certain perfection in man. Now, Noah apparently did not have that perfection. That's why he was caught in conflict. He was an individual who was affected by his emotions. I know when I read Plato, I was really astounded at the portrayal of Socrates, especially, first of all, in the Apology, and especially later in the Phaedo, the way the man faced death. He had certain ideas about death, and he decided that rationally death is not an evil, and he faced it without trepidation, which is an amazing thing. I thought it showed a measure of the man's ability to bring his whole self in line with his knowledge and make himself one unified individual. Now, Noah was not able to do that. You see, what I want to say is when the rabbis say that he lacked perfection, that was the perfection he lacked. The argument among the rabbis is, was it because inherently he couldn't reach that level? Or was it because of the society that he couldn't reach the level? But they both maintain the same position, that he could not reach that level, or he did not reach that level of unification. That's why the conflict expressed itself when the flood was about to come. He really didn't believe it. He mentally, yes, he knew it. But did he feel convinced? The feeling of conviction didn't follow the knowledge. So what happened? When the flood waters rose, then everything was unified, and he went. You see? That's the way it worked. Now, yes?
Didn't Abraham have a similar conflict though when he goes down to Egypt with his wife?
But that wasn't a conflict.
What, did he introduce it as a sister? He had to show a lack of faith in God, if God doesn't put that together.
No, on the contrary, that was not considered a misdemeanor on his part, because that was the proper thing. A person is supposed to protect themselves as much as they can within the natural law. You don't rely on miracles. It's not the not proper. A person is allowed to lie in order to save his wife.
There were different views on that, yeah. You know, on that particular episode.
You mean whether he did properly?
Yeah, properly not, yeah.
At any rate, yes.
I see what you're getting at.
You see, the point is, I'm not saying that everyone that's on that level is completely perfected. There are imperfections in man. Even Moses had imperfections. We don't deify any human beings. Everybody has imperfections. But what I'm trying to show as far as Noah is a specific thing on the whole, a general thing on the whole. In other words, his nature was that he somehow, in general, was unable to bring his emotions in line with his intellect.
So you're saying at that level he was not accepted?
So I'm saying that he, that's why the Torah considers that he was, that's, if a person is that way, it doesn't mean he's not a tzaddik. Because he can perceive the ideas. So you can't say he's not a tzaddik, he is a tzaddik. But nevertheless, he hasn't completely reached the full level. Now let's get back to the other question we raised.
Right.
Question
was, you're bringing this interpretation out, yeah, as if to say that Torah chose to use the phrase "perfect in his generation" to point out his imperfection.
Exactly. Right.
And if it wanted to say that he was imperfect, it would have said that he was even more imperfect. It would have even praised his perfection more. However, if it wanted to point out his perfection, it would have said something about his imperfection. It especially stresses his perfection. In order to teach us from the phrase, because the waters of the flood, he really was imperfect. Is that what you were reading?
No.
You drew out of the Midrash, because the waters of the flood. That was the actual verse you built the whole character of, that whole story that you just built. While it's very interesting and important to me.
Yeah.
You drew it all on the line, because the waters of the flood.
I drew from the Midrash, not from the line.
But they just interpreted that wrong.
Right. So we're operating, we're functioning with the Midrash. I told you before, we are here to understand.
And the Midrash turned that line, the previous line, completely around, right?
Yes. What I'm trying to do is to explain the personality of Noah through the eyes of the Midrash and the Torah. Now, we went through the Midrash, and I read to you the Midrash, right? And I'm trying to explain to you how the Midrash views Noah.
Okay.
Now, I don't understand where you are going now from the words of the Pasuk. I don't understand what
you're saying. You're trying to explain the personality of Noah from the Midrash.
Right.
Midrash. And
right.
It doesn't...
Exactly.
Whether that poses contradictions to the text
I'll tell you, when I get finished, then we'll take the questions that are bothering me in terms of the text. I'm not going to see any difficulties.
Right.
But if you have difficulties, let's take that list. But first, I'd like to get this one, because otherwise, we're not going to get to the essential idea.
Right.
Yes.
I just
want to
ask a question. Why the contradiction about...
Or why the question about
whether the imperfection in
Noah
was caused by his environment or whether it was innate, because it seems to me intuitively that a problem like that would be an innate problem.
Well, it's difficult to say. It's very difficult to say in a specific problem whether it's innate or whether it's something which was caused by a person's circumstance. It really is difficult to track down. But I don't know. I don't have any knowledge in it. I mean, I can't tell you whether I could trace it to a specific shortcoming, to an environmental situation, or to an inherent inability. There is a reference, by the way, in the Nevi'im, in the prophets, to the fact that Noah was not completely perfect. It says, "Ki mei Noach zosli." God says, this is as the waters of Noah. And the rabbis point out, wait, the waters of Noah, the reason why it should have said mei amabel instead of Noah,
because there is an allusion there to the fact that Noah was to blame. And I'm going to get back to this in a moment, and why it was given in the form of an allusion. Okay. Now, what I want to say is like this. Let's take the other problem that we had. Now, I want to answer your textual question, too, but let's take this first. The point was, how could we possibly say that Noah was a righteous man when he didn't go out and didn't bother, he wasn't concerned with humanity? That doesn't seem to us to be righteousness. My answer is like this. That let me start off with a piece of the Chovas Alvaros, a medieval philosopher. He states as follows. He says, there are two types of righteous individuals. There is a person who cannot live in society because he finds that society is imperfect. He sees what's going on, he reads the papers, and knows all the imperfections that are going on, and he sees the corruption of society. So what does this individual do? He withdraws, goes out into the woods, lives by himself, and lives a righteous life. That's one kind of individual. Then there is another kind of individual, one who doesn't withdraw from society, but stays within society, remains unaffected by the corruption of society, and proceeds, on the contrary, to involve himself in changing, turning around the order of society. Now, the Chovas Halevi says both are definitely righteous people. He says, but the one who remains in society is greater. Why? Because he says the one that runs away is not able to withstand the effects of the society. His righteousness is conditional. As long as others aren't there, he can make it. But once he's in a situation where he's faced with others that are not completely righteous, that are might be perhaps corrupt even, then it affects him. He can be affected externally. An individual who can be affected externally is not yet on the level of one who is impervious to external causes. Now, what I want to say is as follows. The difference between these two is not that one is quantitatively greater than the other, but rather that that one is qualitatively greater than the other. The difference is as follows. If an individual is in conflict, if an individual is one whose emotions do not completely go along with his thinking, then society can affect him. Because society, when people see that others are doing these actions which he wants to do, which he naturally has a bent to do, it sort of eases the feelings that he has of guilt or evil in regard to certain performances. His emotions can be affected. But if a person has total knowledge and the total self realizes, follows this knowledge, then no matter what others will do, it won't affect him because he can see it clearly. He's unified. There's no room for the effect to take place. Now, Noah was an individual. When the Torah says Noah did not go out to others, it wasn't because he was a wicked man. Far from it. If he was such an individual and just allow others to drown, then he would never be called righteous. He wouldn't even be mentioned in the Torah. Now, why didn't Noah go out? Noah didn't go out for one reason. Because since Noah was such an individual who had there was a dichotomy in his personality, his emotions, somehow or other, didn't fall in line with his reasoning. He himself was in conflict. He couldn't go out to others. Because had he gone out to others, he would have had to forfeit his own righteousness. So the reason why Noah did not go out was not because he was an evil man, but because he was incapable of it. Abraham went out to others because Abraham was on a different level. He didn't have the conflicts, mamim ve'enam amim. You see? He was a unified individual. To him, the ideas of God were clear as day. He saw everything. He naturally was convinced that this was what he was supposed to do, and he followed it wholeheartedly. There was no danger in his approaching others who had different philosophies. There was nothing that they could generate in him to stir him to go in the opposite direction. Whereas Noah was not such a personality, as you see the rabbis explain. He was an individual who had conflicts. The reason why he couldn't go out was very simple. Not that he didn't want to go out, but he recognized in himself that he was unable to go out, because if he would, then he would cease to be righteous and there would be no one left on the world that is righteous. So Noah realizing this, remained to himself. Now, what?
It sounds like those defenses in court,
right,
in
yeah,
which
very weak,
in which you say, well, it's my bad background. The reason I wasn't righteous of the real type. The reason I wasn't righteous of the real type was that, after all, I had a bad background. My psychological makeup isn't that strong. What could I do? I'm righteous type one. Okay. But it's a very...
But it's a righteousness to recognize your weaknesses.
But what about the earlier comment? I mean, the thing that you led us to initially was, if the building is burning, or if the world is drowning, and you don't go out, then you're not righteous at all. Righteous type 1 doesn't exist.
Let me
know. It's a cop-out righteous.
Let me understand specifically what your question is. The original, what we said originally was that if you stand by while others are being destroyed, like this is not, you are not a righteous individual, correct?
That was the original definition.
Now, let's say for instance, in order for you to save others, you yourself will be destroyed with them. Would that be righteousness to go out and save them? Or would it be rather righteousness to stay home?
Well, you still have to take the righteousness.
You're talking about prudential action as opposed to righteous action. On an ethical scale, you go out. And that's the morally right thing to do. You realize that your own...
But is that the morally right thing to do?
Of course it is.
It is to die with others?
No, not the doctor who goes out into an epidemic-filled area realizes the risk that he's going to take.
Oh,
he knows he's acting on a morally righteous basis.
Absolutely.
Socrates and would be called above the plane of moral righteous. He would be called a martyr. Now, Noah, if he had gone out, would have been a martyr. That's a different category altogether than a simply righteous individual. There's righteous then martyrdom, and then you died.
Okay.
So,
all right.
That's the risk that you take. I agree with you and others that the argument is...
There's a whole other area that we're ignoring. We're talking about his responsibility to others in his generation. But he has a responsibility to succeeding generations, too. It's not his life that's in jeopardy if he goes out to the others and loses it. It's the generations to come. It's he who's going to replenish the earth.
Let me just explain one thing. You see, your argument and your argument is very good, but I think that we're forgetting one thing. I think not that they're wrong.
That's the complimentary denial.
I'm just saying, not that they're wrong, but we're speaking about two different situations. Your situation is not my situation. You said that a doctor that goes out into an area where there's danger of he himself contracting disease is a righteous act. I say yes, I agree with that. But if a doctor would go into an area where he knows that he can do no good and the only result will be that he himself will die, that wouldn't be a righteous act. That would be a foolhardy act.
No, but a person who has the belief, the faith that his actions must be done. He doesn't know about miracles. He follows just what you said before. You don't wait for that.
Right.
You go right in.
Absolutely.
It's morally required of him.
Yes.
Then we talk about the degrees of moral weakness, you know, whether he backs out at the last minute, and that happens. That may perfectly well be the case, you know, with Noah, that he may have tried.
Yes.
But if the Torah doesn't record it because they don't want us to know, you know,
about the cases. I understand the point. What I'm saying is as follows. I am not saying that Noah could have gone out to his generation and succeeded in saving them at his own expense. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that an individual has to know his own situation, and he has to realize that at a certain point, he would be foolish in making an attempt to help others if the result will be absolutely
let's make him a compass. Say, act on this rule. Don't go out to others when you think it's going to be a risk to your own life.
That's not what I said. That's a different situation. I didn't say where it's a risk to your life. I said if you know for certain that you are unable to handle the challenge and that the only thing that will result in is that the people will fall anyways and you yourself will fall.
Well, that's unknowable.
At any moment, there are infants,
there are isolated people. He could not know that. I mean, that's unknowable that there wasn't one other person who might have been influenced by what he did.
I want to take that question right now because I want you to understand something. When the Bible says that Noah didn't go out to others, don't think it means he never spoke to another individual. I mean, this is not what the Medrash means. It's the Medrash, by the way. You're the one that didn't want to accept Medrash. Okay. What the Medrash means was not that he never went out to any individual. It meant that in that area he was essentially limited. That way he didn't put up a tremendous battle. It doesn't mean you think he never spoke to anybody and told anybody that they're liable to die. It means essentially he wasn't able to actually go down into the masses be with the people like Abraham did and really spend time convincing and working with them. He was unable to go into the society, to join in the society and work from within. That's what it means. Therefore, we're not talking about an infantile idea of going over to somebody and saying, hey, you know there's going to be a flood. We're speaking about getting involved in the society as a whole. Not just speaking to individuals, but involving himself in the government and becoming a part of that society and trying to turn the society over. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a mass movement. We're not talking about speaking to an individual, an isolated individual.
No, but even at the individual level, I just don't agree.
On the individual level,
for example, if, I don't maintain that. If he knew at least 20 good people, if he just personally knew them, yes. And when the water started to lick his heels, yes. As it does in Chapter 7, verse 7.
Yeah, right.
But if Dr. Lick his heels, he could say, look, Moish Chaim, come in the ark, now you know it's
going to then he wasn't allowed to. Then he wasn't allowed to. Well, then he wasn't permitted. That was when the flood began. Then he wasn't permitted to do that. The point was not then. That wasn't the time when he should have been doing the convincing. He should have been doing the convincing over the 120 years which preceded the flood. That was the time when he should have changed the society. That's what we're talking about. We're discussing about it. See, why do you understand? You know, we tend to think of, in modern times, we realize there's government and there's positions in society, and we have a complicated system. But when we look back at past civilizations, we think everything was so simple. It's not true. They also had government.
They had intelligence. Things we have to realize. One, yes. I mean, one, his fault may not have been for not going out in the world, but not for arguing with God. That's pointed out also, that he should have argued when he first heard about this. Why didn't he say something?
That so is when he first heard about what?
When he first heard about the flood wiping out the world.
What should he have done?
He could have argued. I mean,
argued with whom?
With God.
People have already done this
earlier.
Yeah, well, that was the point that was mentioned before.
But I think
the question of the justice of the flood. Okay, that's another question. But I'm not discussing that. I'm discussing the fact that he didn't go into the society, become a part of the fiber of the site and attempt to change them to see a different way of life. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about him arguing with God about the flood. When the Medrash criticizes Noah, it's because he didn't go out into the society, mingle with them, become a part of them, and try to turn the society around.
Nor did he draw a small group around himself outside the society.
Yes.
He didn't do that either.
Well, this
I'm not talking about social reform. Yes. I'm talking about even drawing a small group around yourself. A small group of those who know and care. He didn't even do that.
What did he say? Well,
they were under his power.
No, 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 just not. The wife and sons.
Because he had gotten 10.
He did.
Nor did he say
that.
Nor did he say to God that there are 50 righteous men and 40 righteous men. That's something else. That's a different point. There is a key word, I think, that we've come across. That God destroys the world because of the judgment on the robber.
Yes.
There is a key element there which can justify Noah's action, realizing, seeing there's no government in the world, there's no authority, and there is robbery that brings judgment on the world. But to get back, the question I had before, which really bothers me,
yes,
is this subjective view of Noah, whether he's wholly righteous or partially righteous or first level of righteous. I don't think it's the purpose of Torah trying to tell us that. I think what Torah is trying to tell us, as Nate said before, is God wants to save mankind. The only way he can save mankind is to destroy everybody else who's going to destroy everybody anyway. And to save this one guy who might have a kernel within him of survival for that element of righteousness. And what Torah is telling us, even at that level of righteousness, there was enough maybe to let the world go on.
Yeah, I understand that. Right? You see, if you say that, then you have to strike this passage out, because when it says that Noah, why does the Bible elaborate upon the fact that Noah was so righteous? That would be a difficult point. All it has to say is that God saw this man, and he knew that from this man he would be able to save the creation, and that's it. But we're trying to understand the way the Bible's written. Now, the Bible is over here. You have a full sentence, and you have sentences before which state that Noah was a righteous person. As a matter of fact, if you take a look strictly at the text, you'll find that the world was supposed to be totally destroyed. And the reason why Noah was saved was because of his righteousness. But actually, the law of nature at that time was that there should be total destruction. It required another system in order to save Noah completely.
But you do have a comparative level with Enoch before, who says he wasn't, the Torah does not call him righteous, but he walked with God. I think what you have here is level. He walked with God, but not sufficient enough for God to bank on him to continue with the world. Noah was at level two, who was tzaddik enough to carry on. And I think that's what the Torah may be. I'm just my personal interpretation.
is telling us in comparison these two individuals.
Yes.
Enoch before, yes. No. Noah will take a chance on maybe this guy will make it through. He doesn't make it through. Right?
Yeah.
And that's right.
Well,
yes. God takes a chance on him.
He takes a chance on
Adolf. I haven't heard Lamech's name mentioned, but my own view of this is that there's a development of the moral personality from the time of Adam up through Abraham. With Lamech, you have the completely amoral individual. Then an immediate contrast to him, Lamech is the person who does evil. Noah is the person who does know evil, but he doesn't do any good. And then with Abraham, he's the person who does know evil and does positive, brings goodness into the world. So the development of the lesson is that for the good society, you need the two aspects, to avoid evil, but also to promote goodness. So I wouldn't claim that Noah...
How can you avoid evil and not do good? How can a person avoid evil and not do good?
I can hear the cries of people and not heed them.
And you said that's just avoidance of evil and not doing good?
Well, a hermit can avoid evil and not do any positive good. He doesn't have to be going out and doing mitzvahs. He's just avoiding evil.
Well, let me ask you. Let me ask you a question. Let's say, for instance, a person's life is in front of you. His life is at stake. Now, could I say that I will avoid evil, I won't kill him, but I won't do any good? Isn't that truly the greatest evil, to just do nothing?
It's not fair to ask us. We're the result of this development. We see ourselves now, but we're seeing the stage.
Well, he's speaking in our terms. I think you're speaking in our terms, right?
No, I'm trying to defend Noah and his righteousness.
I see.
And see that we're asking too much of him. Yeah. And the Torah, I don't think, you know, is by the contrasts of characters that it places, of Lamech and then Abraham, it shows us that we can try to reach up to certain goals, but that even, I was just checking back, you know, to see in chapter 9, Chapter 8, because the imagery of man's heart is evil from his youth.
That's right.
The very next recognition. Right. We'll never reach that perfect stage of perfection. We're always pulled by the evil inclination.
Sure. So, there's no question about that, yes. Well, that's exactly what I'm saying about Noah. I'm saying that he was an individual that was pulled, that was torn. Precisely. Exactly right. That's what I'm saying. But the one thing I'm saying in addition is that if an individual senses that he himself will lose his righteousness, and that sometimes an individual, if he can know this, he is not obligated to forfeit his life, because if the forfeiture of his life will do accomplish nothing but his own destruction and the possible destruction of succeeding generations. As I mentioned before, Noah had an obligation not just to himself, but he had an obligation to succeeding generations as well. Now a person has to know what choice to make. I know it's a difficult thing to comprehend.
But dying is martyrs.
I want you to say something. Dying as martyrs is not considered a great thing. We don't just try to become martyrs. To just die is not considered a great deed. As a matter of fact, the person just causes his own death. It's considered the worst sin that there is. It's even worse than murder.
What an unbelievable risk he took.
Yes, but I'm not saying a person shouldn't take risk. I'm saying as long as there's a possibility, yes. But can you envision a situation where there's no possibility? Let me ask you a question. Could you envision a situation where there's no possibility? There's absolutely no possibility of accomplishing your mission.
Accomplishing any good by trying to affect anybody.
No, I'm not saying trying to affect anybody in society. Here it was a question of turning over the whole society. The world would not be saved, and we don't know any. As I said before, it doesn't say that Noah had no people that followed him. The point was, in order to save the world at this time, what was necessary for him would be to completely involve himself on a great scale to change over the society. That he was unable to do. Now, a person has to be able to recognize his weaknesses, too. I mean, I know that it's a difficult thing to do, but a person has to be able to realize there's a certain amount that I could do, more than that I can't do. Rabbi Brody is a rabbi in this town. He attempts to do everything he can to help the community, but he still is a human being, and he's limited. I, in my situation, am limited as well. I'll give you an example. If a person, it's good to help others, right? Is it good to help others to the detriment of your health? Until a person becomes ill and dies, would that be wise? Or would it not be more wise to take care of your health so that you can help more individuals over a longer lifespan? A person has to be able to make decisions in life. You can't just feel, I want to be righteous. This is the righteous thing. Here I go. I'm jumping into the fire. That's not righteousness. That's foolishness. Rabbi. So that what I'm saying is that Noah realized, sensed in himself, that he was a man of conflict, a man of ambivalence, as he is portrayed later. He had ambivalent feelings. Now, a person with ambivalence
a surgeon with an unsteady hand, it is not wise for him to enter a delicate operation. An individual who himself is fraught with ambivalence should not, cannot, go into a situation where he has such mass opposition and think that he's going to come out successful. That's ridiculous. You have to know whether you are the person. Sometimes you can do more harm than good. In many situations, a person feels he's qualified, and he jumps into the situation, and precisely because he isn't qualified, he could be doing more harm than if he would have done nothing. Maybe somebody else will come along and help the situation. A person can't always... Doing is a wonderful virtue. But a person has to know when he can do and when he should abstain. If you are not the individual that has the capabilities, then don't do anything. You might be doing more harm to others and to yourself. A person has to use intelligence to discriminate when he should act and when he shouldn't act. What I am saying about Noah is that he was intelligent enough to realize that with his ambivalence, with his situation, going into society would not do anything. It would not help this society. Not only that, but it would destroy him, destroying him and the rest of the future of mankind, which would have been a foolhardy act. So therefore, I say a person should certainly attempt to be just and should certainly do goodness, and he should help his neighbor and help everyone that he can, but it has to be within reason. He can't just jump into, here I am, I'm ready for the sacrifice. Tie me down and burn me up. That's absurdity.
How did you decide that Noah had to turn the whole society around in order to have at least tried to turn some fraction of society around?
Well,
how did you place that burden on him?
I would
as a necessary condition, and then... consequently be able to conclude
that
his mission was impossible.
I would conclude that from one thing. Because the Torah says, when the Torah depicts the state that existed, the Torah says, Kimolo ha'aretz hamas mitnah. The entire world simply reeked with corruption. It wasn't a small matter to just go in there and just try to pull away one or two people. The society was judged as a whole. There was a necessity to change the actual state of humanity at that time.
God might have put a few more on the boat.
I don't know if that's so. I'm not so sure. The only one, I don't believe that's so. Because actually the society was condemned as a whole. And the only one that was put on the boat was Noah because of his extreme righteousness.
But he put his family on for the sake of Noah. He would have put the good friends on for the sake of Noah.
I don't know what he would have done. I can't tell what God would have done. He would have done it, but let's face it, he didn't do it. Yes?
You're raising a very, very interesting point, and very important, but and the import of what I think you're saying is, subjectively,
yeah.
You can judge at what point it's suicidal, accomplishing
your
point.
Yes, sometimes you can't judge, right?
All right, but that becomes very, very troubling because when you get to a story like Pinchas,
right,
who goes in and commits murder,
right,
and destroys a prince of Israel and a
right.
princess of Moabite, and God says you're a great man for doing it.
Right.
And this is an action before he's ordered to do it. He does it on
right.
his own initiative.
Yes.
And very disturbing for people that go into their own hands, or
no,
they
don't
take law into
their own hands. Excuse me. If you want to go into Pinchas, we have to understand what happened to Pinchas.
It's a whole different.
It is. Well, I can tell you briefly what it is. Pinchas followed a halacha. If you look at Chazal, at the way Chazal told it, there was a law. The law was already stated that that was the correct procedure. He didn't just do it emotionally. There was a law which stated that Kanan Pogba. That's the law of Kanan Pogba. It's a law.
He's saying he didn't act. After the act, it wasn't done. It wasn't justified. There's a halacha gives a situation under these circumstances how to act.
If there's a law that says that you're allowed to go in, if somebody breaks the law, you're allowed to personally go in and kill
him. The halacha is if an individual should openly. Now the case was where he was living openly with a pagan
right.
in front of the entire congregation as a degradation to God. That a person is allowed to go and kill that man on sight. That's the law.
So during the act.
That's a law. That's a law.
There are a lot of qualifications to it. I mean, it's not just a halacha. First of all, it has to be there during the act. It can't be after the act. It has to be.
But it wasn't just a rash judgment. This is part of the halacha system. Well, Sanhedrin, why is
what
this
are you
if you want to say wrong system, the point is it's not any more difficult to understand than Sanhedrin execution than any execution. Why is it different than any execution?
Well, because the execution is carried out by government and law, exactly what the case we had.
Well, over here it's also
that's
halacha. It's over here in front of the whole
Sanhedrin. Halacha is carried out by a court, not by an individual.
Yeah, but over here the whole court sees what's going on. In other words, there is an action which can be performed in front. If a man is going to commit murder in front of everybody, you can shoot him. Well, it's as simple as that. I mean, you don't have to wait till you get the court of law. It's going to be too late then. The man is about to shoot somebody. Everybody's sitting there. 100 people sitting there. You take a gun. You shoot him. That's the law. It's not any different than that. It's all right.
put aside for the question.
Are you coping any more examples?
But still, in all the concept of subjective judgment,
right,
as to whether I will act or not act.
Yes.
It's almost a self-righteousness.
Subjective. You mean to say that you can do away with subjective judgment? How could a person live without subjective judgment? Don't you have to judge your qualities?
The question that Ron raised, yeah, is a doctor who goes into an epidemic-filled jungle.
Yes.
Knowing very well there's a very strong chance he may never walk out.
Yes, but he knows
he
very well
he may help somebody, right?
Is there
Noah's case, or I'm my stupidity, I don't understand the difference between he and Noah who would go and possibly save a human being.
Look, what about... Let's take
that's
a
different
case.
Right, let's have
doesn't it resolve the conflict? If you look at the sweetness of not being able to look at himself for what he really is,
yes,
you have the question that's not really righteous because
right,
he didn't go out and save the generation.
Right.
I think that resolves the conflict very well because if you can say that Noah was able to look at himself and truly see himself for what he was, that makes him a righteous man.
That's right, exactly right. What were you going to say?
Oh, well, the whole
really
point is that Noah is given a task. No, that's only a principle. There's a task. He's told to build a teva, and he's told that he has to save himself and he has to save life. Okay? What you're asking isn't for him to do a righteous thing in the absence of that involvement. It's as if a person is given a task to guard an encampment. He's walking guard. And he sees off in the distance a member of his army and another troop is being attacked. It's a righteous thing for him to go to the aid of his fellow and desert his post of guard where people are depending on him? Of course not. It's a righteous act to go and save another man's life. But it's not a righteous act to go and save another man's life by deserting your primary function where other people's lives are in jeopardy.
Okay, I like that defense because it's so... It needs such a strange argument. That is, he was so busy working on the darn ark that he didn't have a moment left.
Well, as
to
a matter
go
of
tell
fact,
anybody.
Of course, it's an important thing. If there had been a drought, okay, or a shortage of food, would you have expected him as a righteous act to go scurrying around, planting or going to some place to get grain to bring back to his fellow men, instead of completing the ark in time? And then as the waters of the Mabul start rising, you never got around to putting the pitch in. What kind of silly is that? The point is he's got a tremendously important task.
You don't think that audience rather imagine that. I mean, you really
pulled that
out.
Don't we
argue night and day on
no,
an ark for 100
don't
years?
We avoid all the problems if we just
lose?
Go back to the description of the time, the description of generation, and assume the interpretation that Noah was righteous compared to most of the people around him. And that's all. I mean, he wasn't as righteous as other people, maybe in other generations, but clearly compared to, he wasn't going around robbing people, killing people.
Isn't
he's willing to settle down.
That doesn't answer the question, Bob. The question was, what is righteousness? Is an absolute minimum to righteousness.
Well,
you can't let other people
right,
die in this
that's
planet.
Right.
No, we don't know. We haven't got
that's
the absolutes
true
yet. The
that's
absolutes
true
aren't even on the earth yet.
Because you can bring 1,000 cases where it's perfectly righteous to let other people die.
This is the early question.
But
that's
the only two. Those were the only in that particular instance. Those were the only two things. One was to sit here, without any other demands, right? We were sitting here comfortably, and we knew something was happening over there, and we ignored it. But that's not the case with Noah. Noah had something else that was also very important for him to do. That's crucial.
The Torah calls him righteous.
The point is, if he tried
to complete that mission by trying to save the other members of the society, he would have failed in his mission because he couldn't have done it.
How do you know?
You don't know that. You don't know
that's the point that the rabbi was saying.
That's an invented argument.
But that's the interpretation of the Midrash that he believed and he didn't believe.
Yes. The argument seems to be over what is righteousness. That seems to be the discussion. What is righteousness?
He would have failed.
I think I know a way of defending him for Sean.
The question is it righteous to save a life under what conditions?
I really hate to be ignorant.
But the fundamental question is, what is righteousness?
Right.
Okay, is it following mitzvah? Right. Or is it doing one's duty in the face of other duties? I mean, how do you evaluate righteousness? It's not enough to say that he knew his own limitations.
Yeah.
Because people every day say they know their own limitations and are really selling themselves short.
Yes.
So how can we evaluate what righteousness is given Noah's own estimation of himself?
Well,
he may have been wrong.
The point of Malthus is that it's true that there are people that feel that they're limited and are selling themselves short. But the fact remains nevertheless that a person has to make a decision about his own abilities. And there comes a time when you have no choice. The surgeon, before he goes into an operation, he has to make a decision. Am I capable? Am I not? Maybe he's selling himself short. Maybe he's selling himself tall. You don't know. But there comes a point in a person's life where he has no choice but to make a decision whether he can or he can't do something. Other people's lives depend upon it. His life depends upon the situation. Now, what I am saying is that Noah found himself in a situation in which he had to make an evaluation of his own abilities.
Right.
And it was one way or the other. If he would lose over there, he'd lose everything. Now, the question was, which way should he go? He was clear. He couldn't say, well, I'll be righteous. I'll be a good person. I'll run out there. Running out there would be bad for other reasons. A person sometimes is caught in a moral contradiction. There are two ways to go. Should I do that? Should I save him? But then again, I have that other person to save. What would you do if you saw two people equidistant from you and you felt you had a better chance? They were both dying, but you felt you had a better chance to save that one than that one. What would you do? You say, well, look, I mean, I definitely just to go try to save somebody who was more saving more far-fetched instance would be ridiculous. A person has to use reason in righteousness. Righteousness is very nice, but there must be reason also. If there's no reason in it, it will fail. Now, Noah had to make a decision about his own capabilities, just like the surgeon has to before he goes into an operation. He has to say, one second, can I do it or can't I do it? Am I going to do more harm or more good? And unfortunately, in life, you can't always say, whatever I'm going to do is going to be good. Sometimes you can do more harm than good. And you must make an evaluation. Granted that our abilities in self-evaluation are limited, but the fact remains, at some point in the person's life, a person has to make certain self-evaluations. And the only thing we're saying is that Noah found himself in a situation where he had to make that evaluation. Now, whether he was right or whether he was wrong is a different question. I would say the Bible would seem to speak about it two ways. In one respect, they seem to say he was right, because they openly praise him, and yet, sort of hinting, alluding, in an alluding manner, they seem to blame him. The reason for that is very simple. Because actually, he was in a situation where he couldn't possibly. He was right. His self-evaluation was correct. But the point is, he could have worked. He could have raised himself to a higher level. If he would have raised himself to a higher level, then he would have been able to do it. In other words, you can't blame the man directly because his decision was correct. But still, the fact remains that it was because of his shortcoming that it occurred indirectly. You see, that's why openly the Torah praises him, because he really made the correct decision. But nevertheless, he still could have done something. If he would have perfected himself to a higher degree, then he could have done it. So it's an indirect blame. That's why the blame in the Torah comes out as an illusion rather than an open blame. You mentioned before, why do the rabbis say mitnei mehamavol? They pick on bederosah, on these little things. He may know achzosli. The reason is because he was to blame in an indirect sense. Directly, he made the right decision. He was faced with a situation, an ethical situation, which demanded reasoning. He had to decide, shall I accomplish more good by running and jumping into that society, or by staying here and saving myself and saving the future world? What should I do? He was caught in the dilemma. So he had to come to a conclusion. His conclusion was correct. But had he perfected himself to a greater degree, he would have been able to go into the society. So you can't blame him directly, because he wasn't that perfected. But indirectly, he is to blame. And that's why the blame is expressed as an illusion and not openly in the pasuk. Openly he receives praise. He did the correct thing. But there was a shortcoming, an indirect shortcoming, you see, which resulted in the mabul. Okay.
And he wasn't obligated, you say, to try to at least save whoever he could.
No, because that would have been foolish.
There's another argument for that. That argument
why would it have
been
foolish?
No.
Not that he built the ark. Says there's a model to people. So listen, I believe this, that this is going to happen enough. That I'm going to spend 120 years building this ark. Okay? The building of the ark itself...
Oh, that turns the argument totally around. That says the building of the ark was the going out into society, but it wasn't.
No, I would say this. I say that it seems in the Bible that the decree was that the society had to be changed around. Otherwise, individuals was not enough at that time.
he would have to involve himself in the society. He mullaharatzhonzhonam. Just to change individuals, even those individuals would not be saved. The only individual that were going to be saved was Noah. Unless the society would have, he would have turned around the society. And apparently, had he reached a higher degree of perfection, he would have saved, he would have been able to save the society. So here we see a man who lives in a society who is unable to help them. And who, in his situation, made a just decision. As strange as it sounds, I know it sounds strange to say, well, why doesn't he go out and help? Because a person has to use reason. Sometimes you can do more harm than good in that situation.
Right, the way he got him out of the problem is to say that he knew for sure that they would all die, so it was hopeless to try.
He was told that
they
would all die.
It was hopeless
to try
to even get a few.
He was told that they were all going to die. And I said that he could not save an isolated individual. Now, that wasn't... The decree apparently was that the whole society was
going to... He should have always hoped that God's mercy would change his mind. The more people... He should have always hoped that if he was satanic.
No, I didn't say that he didn't do that. I said he didn't put himself in the midst of the society. That's what he didn't do. I didn't say he didn't speak to any individuals.
No,
he wasn't
doing
enough.
Yes.
When I was a little boy, my rabbi told me, I don't know what the source was.
He was a tzaddik because he knew his limitations.
Yes.
That when he was building the ark, people asked him, what are you doing?
Right. That's right.
And he told them,
that's right, there's going to be a flood.
There's going to be a flood.
He did tell them.
And they laughed at him.
That's right.
From that, he deduced that there was no use talking to them. He hasn't got what it takes to sell them the idea.
After the conversation, one of the questions which the Malbim discusses in great length is the nature of the Hatzalah, of the saving of Noah. And, you know, it raises a very interesting point. I think it's not an interesting point, but a central point to the whole incident of the Malbim. Says the Noach is going to be saved, and the rest of the society destroyed. So as the Medrash says, there are many, many methods which the Almighty could have chosen, to save Noach. Could have saved Noach by putting him on an island where the flood wouldn't come, or it could have been in a miraculous manner.
Right.
So the question is, why did the Almighty elect in order to save him via the ark? There have been many other methods. And it's a good question, and what the Malbim says as follows, and I think this is really a positive of the entire conversation, is that the Hatzalah, the same that which Noach experienced, was not that Noach was really separate from the entire generation, but the decree was that the whole world had to be destroyed. And as a result, Noach was also included in that decree. There, the fact that he had to be, the fact that he had to go and create a table, and go into the table, it was a way of really showing that really the decree was not only against the generation, but it was also against them. It was a separate way of going into the table, which was upon the waters, which was still part of the society, still related to the arts. There is that. Then you said, "That's why." Why is it? The Malbim goes a little further. It says that if you take a look at the pasuk very carefully, the pasuk uses a very technical lashon. It says. Hinini mashkis neretz esaretz. That's the pasuk. I don't see where exactly where it's. Let's see what the pasuk is.
Hinini mashkis esaretz.
Hinini mashkis esaretz. I'm going to destroy the earth. Now, if you take the pasuk literally, what does the word esaretz mean?